3, we move to the inhomogeneous universe. And today we'll look at another interesting and very very powerful and very topical probe, which is the gravitational lensing. And this might be after, this is the last 3, bionic acoustic oscillation, gravitational lensing, and CMB are probably the most active observational programs going on right now in cosmology. So it's quite interesting. Okay, so I'll show you first, show you the history very quickly, give you a very brief and qualitative overview of the theory, very few questions, just a few ideas, and I'll give you some reviews if you want to look more into it. It's very interesting, but a lot of detail to understand. Then I'll explain you how can, I'll show you some results, but interesting results obtained by looking at gravitational lensing by clusters of galaxies that we talked about yesterday. And then I will show you what we call cosmic shear, which is like the gravitational lensing signal, but on scales much larger than galaxy clusters, okay? And okay, so one basic equation from GR, the one we will need around here, basically, so imagine you have a massive object here, okay, and imagine you have a ray of light coming here with a cross distance of B, okay, so basically you can predict that the deflection angle, okay, which is this angle here and the observer is here, is given by this expression, right? Fourth and Newton constant, the mass divided by C squared B, okay? And so you see that the smaller B, the bigger the deflection, okay? And this is pure GR. And if you were trying to do that in a Newtonian limit, you will get the same result, qualitative same result, except with a factor of 2, okay? But so this is like, and you notice that this is, this result is independent of lens, which means that in principle, if you can observe, if this effect is observable, okay, you could observe it at any wavelength, okay? And so, just to make it very clear and simple, the observers will see the object, will think, like imagine this is a star, so the observer who is here will think that the star is here, whereas actually it is here, okay, and there's this deflection angle. Now, imagine, so we know, if you look at nearby objects that have been known for a long time, and for example, we can look at the sun, and you can wonder what would be, for example, can the sun deflect, and kind of, can the sun, is the sun massive enough to deflect the light from background stars, okay? And actually the answer is maybe, and the deflection angle for star behind the sun will be about 1 arc second, okay, or let's say 2 arc second. So it's very, it's really, really small, so you have to be very careful. Photometry, or astrometry, but it's actually been done, and it's a famous Eglinton experiment, which was done in 1919, right, which was the first, or maybe the second, strong proof of GR, observational proof of GR, okay? And so what happened is that so the problem is that you want to, so remember I told you from this lensing equation, the smaller the object is from the mass, the lensing, the lens mass, the bigger the effect. So you want on a star which is very nearby, this would be nearby the sun. But of course, it's really hard to observe the sun is a very bright object, so it would be very hard to imagine to look at an object which is like 1 arc second away from the sun, okay? So it, in practice, it's totally impossible. So the way they did it, and it was a device by Eglinton, was to actually look for a solar eclipse, total solar eclipse. They went, so one happened in Principe Island, which is just west of Africa, right, in Guinea, just off Guinea. And they went for this island during the total eclipse and look at a star they observed before, and look at its, measure its position, and measure its position later on. And then they were able to see that the star has actually moved by the right amount. And as I said earlier, this deflection angle was twice what is expected from the Newtonian approximation. And so this was considered the most, the strongest observational proof that GR was actually valid on the right theory. And this is what made Einstein a celebrity, as we would say now. And so within a year after this event, like more than 100 books were written on GR, right? And so, I mean, popular books, not textbooks. Okay. And this is, so this is not, just to tell you, this is not a new idea, right? It's almost a century old now. So it's been in the air for quite a while. Another, so if you still play with this idea, people realize very early on that actually, imagine you have, what happens is you have a perfect alignment between the lens and the source, okay, on the observer. If the three are perfectly aligned, you have a totally axial symmetry, so there is no reason you won't break the symmetry. So by symmetry, you can expect that the lens image will be a ring, okay, and not a collection of images. And this is what was called the Einstein ring, okay, and it was predicted earlier on. Einstein himself studied that, and he was interested in stars, and he thought that it wouldn't be observable by star, and he was right, because star would burn, let's say the effect would be too small for stars. But if you actually look at galaxies, which are, wasn't really feasible then at all, you see that for a galaxy of 10 to the 11 solar mass and a distance of for the source of about 1 gigaparsec, okay, you see that the Einstein ring opening angle is about 1 arc second, okay? So 1 arc second is kind of pretty hard, right? It's Hubble. So there is a, in astronomy, there's a quantity which we call the seeing. I'm not sure if you're familiar with it, but basically if you observe from the ground, like the turbulence in the atmosphere will introduce some, even if you have a very punctual object like a star, you won't be able to, this object will be blurred, okay? And usually, typically, for the very good side, very good night, it's about 1 arc second. So it means that from the ground, it's actually very hard to do that. But if you go to space, for example, you don't have atmosphere anymore, so you don't have seeing, or just seeing is much better, and it goes down to, let's say, half arc second. So it means that for Hubble telescope, it would be feasible to observe this kind of effect. And actually, if you decrease D, so if you consider a smaller, a closer source, the Einstein ring gets bigger, and actually you enter like in a 10 arc second, 10 arc second regime, and then it becomes within reach of a radio telescope, okay? Because radio telescope, you can build easily much bigger dish because you don't need the same surface quality, right? So you can build like 30 meter, 100 meters dish for radio telescope, and with this kind of resolution, you can reach this quantity. And that's actually how the first Einstein ring was discovered. It was first spotted by the VLA, which is like a ground-based radio interferometer, and then there was a follow-up by Hubble, and you obtain this image here, where you have a galaxy here and another galaxy in the background, which is lensed to form a total ring. Okay, and you see another one here. You see a full ring. And now it has been observed many times, and now we actually have observed multiple rings, where we are the source and the lens, no, the lens, the source, and then another source, and it gives you a family of rings. So it's quite interesting, and it's a well understood phenomena. Yeah.
What was that?
Arc
seconds? Is that just
diffraction
limited, or?
Yeah, diffraction size of the mirror. Yes. Okay. So those are very spectacular effects. And yes, it's 1.5. The mirror is 1.5. It's 1.5 meter for Hubble, so it sets you the sun. Okay, so just to tell you that this gravitational lensing has been thought of very quickly after GR was invented. Several effects were imagined then already. Einstein ring was one of them, and it was later observed. I forgot the date, but this is like 20 years ago, more or less. So it has been here. Okay, so I will review a little more. I will go into a little more details about the theory, and I'll give you define the deflection angle, the critical density, and I look at circularly symmetric lenses or non-circularly symmetric lenses. Okay, so common approximation when you deal with lensing is basically what is called is the screen approximations, which is the fact that basically you consider that the thickness of the lens is always is negligible as compared to the distances involved, like the distance from the observer to the lens, or from the lens to the source, and from the observer to the source. Okay, so basically you can consider that the lens is like a sheet with a mass density, okay, uniform mass density. So that the screen approximation and the mass that will matter here is a mass which is basically enclosed within your light ray bundles, okay? And it's interesting to, and so for if you have a constant mass shift density sigma, the deflection angle can be written this way, okay, where alpha is the deflection angle, 4 pi g, dd is distance from the observer to from the observer to the lens to the source, then from the distance source and distance observer source. Thank you. So there are those are the three distances that matters here, and these distances here are actually angular diameter distance, which I defined yesterday. And so that you understand that from gravitational lensing, you are sensitive to two things. You are sensitive to the mass density of the object, of the lens. So you can learn, if you measure this precisely, you can learn something about the mass density of the object. And you also learn something about the angular diameter distance involved. And so it means that you will be sensitive to cosmology exactly the same way as we said yesterday, right, for BAOs or CMB. So this is GA. And this is like a mass density. And so lensing will allow you to learn about the lens and about the overall geometry of the universe. And so it's interesting to define this critical density here, which you draw a subfraction of this, which gives you, which is a critical quantity for lensing observation. And it basically tells you how strong the lensing effect will be. And for mass density, which are bigger than the critical density, you will be able to form multiple images. And you will be in a regime what we call the strong lensing regime. Okay. And for mass density, which are smaller than this critical density, you will be like, more like in a weak lensing regime. And you won't be able to distort. You won't form multiple images if you have a single source. Okay. And so typically, that's a kind of system you might have. And here, it's very, after that, it's all, you can draw all kind of analogies, of course, with optics, with regular optics. And here is some kind of configuration you can have. This is the lens distribution. These are two different caustics. And according to the position of the position of the source with regard to the observer lens system, you can form, for example, you can see it, you will be able to form multiple images, distorted. The source is initially a circular. You will be able to form multiple images, okay, like the reds are family, the green corresponds to another position, and the blue to another one, okay? Or you can have, this, for a circular system, you can have this kind of, just look at this one. So you see that according to the exact geometry of the system, you will be able to form multiple images with various distortion. And a famous illustration of that is the Einstein cross, which was observed by the space, you will have a space telescope again. And what you have here, you have a galaxy, okay, at redshift 0.04, okay, which lenses a quasar, which is a very bright object, you know, at higher distance, at a redshift of 1.7. And the configuration of the system is such that actually you form four images of the quasar. And so the way to do that, of course, if you are skeptical, and people were skeptical, of course, is that how do you know this is not just luck, right? How do you know this is not just by coincidence there are four objects which form a cross and you interpret it as a lensing? So the way you do that is that you actually, if you take real-time spectroscopy of each of the subjects, or not necessarily real-time, but if you look at the spectra of each of these four points here, you see that they have exactly the same redshift. Okay, so it means that they are, so that's one thing. So they are not There is no projection effect. They are exactly at the same distance from the observer. And also, if you look at the time evolution of the quasar spectra, which you know are strongly evolving quantities, you can actually see that those guys are their spectra is evolving simultaneously. Okay, so and also you can convince yourself that actually this is really a lens system and not just a lab coincidence. Okay. So there's it doesn't cause it problem is a point of view, but it gets an effect. And if you try, for example, to look at let's say you have a galaxy population of object galaxy, and you try to measure the luminosity function. Okay, then for example, you try to count how many. So the luminosity function is the number of objects for a given luminosity. Okay, and then you will see, for example, there is a bias. You will have more luminous objects, more distance luminous objects than you think. And actually, this is because, for example, you will have what we call magnification, which is the fact that you have the light from this object will be magnified by the intervening matter. So yes, when you do things carefully, when you try to look at the light properties of distant objects, most of the time you have to take into account lens. All right. So just another just to illustrate the critical density again. If you are imagine you have a cluster of galaxies here. You have one background galaxy here, and you have a typical. Here, according to exactly the geometry of the system, according to where the observer is with regard to the axis, let's say cluster and background galaxy, you will see different phenomena. So if you're looking straight into the galaxy center, of course the projective density of your lens will be much higher than if you look further away, right? There is much less mass here, so the average density over this area, this sheet, is much bigger, smaller than the average density over just this sheet. Okay, so in one regime you will have a critical density which is greater than the critical density. In the other case, you will have a density which is smaller than the critical density, and this will affect exactly the observation. And for example, if you look here, you will see strongly distorted image, multiple images, and you'll see arcs typically. Okay? And if you look far away, you will see a galaxy which looks like just regular galaxy, but slightly distorted. Okay, so there won't be multiple images, there won't be mass, there won't be a lot of distortion. It will be slightly elongated or slightly circularized accordingly. Okay, and so this will go with the weak lensing regime, and this will be called the strong lensing regimes. Okay, and there is, of course, it's a continuum evolution here. So here you go to multiple images, to arclets, which are like objects which are almost a full arc, and then to just regular galaxy, slightly distorted. So just to repeat the same thing, strong lensing, multiple images, strong arcs, and basically you are sensitive to the denser part, so you want a very strong projective density, so you are sensitive to the densest part of the cluster, and so you will probe like the really inner core of the few inner kiloparsec of your galaxy clusters, where for weak lensing you will be sensitive to the mass distribution on much larger scale, and you'll be sensitive to basically megaparsec scales or even bigger. Okay, and what you will see, that you will see that your typical galaxies are not, none of them are spherical, so they're already elliptical galaxies, and you see that they are slightly more elongated or slightly rotated. Okay, and those are the two regions of interest. Now, imagine we have a cluster whose density, whose mass density is the following, a unit of critical density. Okay, so you see that you are above the critical density in the center, and when you are far away, you go to a fraction of the critical density. Okay, and it's just like angle on the scale. So it's basically at an arc minute, so 4 arc minutes wide. So it's typical. Let's say this would be a cluster at Z0.5, a galaxy cluster at Z0.5. So now you can wonder what would happen to if you have a family of circular galaxy in the background. Okay, what would happen to their shape? Okay, and that's what they would be distorted. So so you see galaxies, circular galaxies on the edge are hardly distorted, and if you move closer and closer to the center, things are more and more deform or stretch and elongated, and that's what is quantified by this plot. Okay, and so on. Of course, you see that there is a direct correlation between the strength, the density, and the deformation. Okay, the distortion. Okay, and so usually what is done is you define the distortion field. It's a 2x2. You write that as a matrix, right? So you have an object and you apply linear transformation to it, and so you decompose it in a, so it's a tensor, it's a stressless tensor, and you decompose it into one part which is just a magnification, which is the fact that it will increase the size of your object. Okay, for example, that's what you see here. So objects doesn't affect the shape; it's a diagonal. But that affects just the size, okay? So circular object remains circular. But then there's also another component, which is the shear, which will distort object and deform them, okay? Which is, for example, what you see here for the same system. And you build what you call shear mass. So you can devise statistics for that, and you reconstruct shear mass. So you look at it's a bit like measuring polarization. If you want, you measure local polarization of the sky, and you decompose that into a curl mode or a curl free mode, and this will be shear or convergence or magnification. Okay, and so I will talk about the, and you, there's all you can, if you write it properly, you can devise the right estimators for shear and for magnification. Now, in practice, how do we do that? It's because you know that galaxies are very, but because they are the result of a very long evolution and totally nonlinear effect, none of them are circular, right? And none of them, not only that, but none of them are. You observe one galaxy, and this is the galaxy you observe is lens, right? So there is no way you can know the original form. There is no way you know the intrinsic elliptic of the galaxy. So the way it works is that what you will look is that you will try to find the coherent shear pattern, so the coherent distortion across the sky. So imagine you have a set of galaxies, okay, which are the blue circles here, and they're just galaxies of different, it's a symbol for galaxies of different shapes, you know, different ellipticities, and they are randomly oriented. And you take all these galaxies and you average their shape, okay, and you get a blue circle. And not surprisingly, it's totally random, so there is no preferred direction. So you get a circular. If you measure the shape of your average galaxy, it will be totally circular. Okay. On the other hand, if you have a coherent distortion field across this plane, if you have a coherent shear field across this plane, if you average the shape, and this will be like the red galaxies. No, I mean, if you average it, because it's all those things are, the orientation of this object is correlated. If you average it, you end up with a actually non-null ellipticity. Okay, and this is how you measure the gravitational lensing signal in practice. So you will take hundreds of galaxies or hundred thousands of galaxies, and you will measure. Let's say you make a little bit in the sky, like a few arcseconds, and you will average the shape of the galaxy within this bin, and this will give you a measure of the shear in this bin. Okay, and that's how it is done in practice. Okay, and of course you do that properly in terms of statistics, but that's basically it. So you really look at the coherent distortion field over population of background galaxies. Okay, so one application is, of course, one interesting family of objects to look for gravitational effects are galaxy clusters or clusters of galaxies. Why? Because, of course, they are the most massive objects we know. So it's really, you expect these effects to be, that's where you expect the gravitational lensing effect to be the biggest, right? And so here you have a cluster at something here at redshift 0.4. So that is the lens. It's a lens. It's a lens cluster, and you look at the distortion field of background galaxies here, and you can using that you can measure the shear field around this cluster, and you see of course you have a circular symmetry around the highest mass density, and so I'll show you a little more about that. So clustered galaxy is not only so typical mass, so that as it's the most massive virialized object in the universe. Okay, typically clustered galaxy is like contains up to from 1,000 up to 10,000 galaxies, so it's really 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 big objects. But they are not actually their mass doesn't come from galaxy. The galaxy contribution to the mass budget is actually subdominant, and it's basically only 1%. Okay, and then you have 10 to 20% of the mass which comes from a hot gas, which is basically so you have a very and then the rest is dark matter. So you have basically what you have is that you have a very wide dark matter potential, okay, megaparsec size, a little less, a little more, depending. Then you have some interstellar mediums, so basically hot gas fall into it, okay, and the gas, because it compresses adiabatically for the most part, you expect the gas will go up to, basically you can relate the virial mass of the cluster to the temperature, and gives you temperature for this plasma, for this gas of up to 10 to 4, 10 to 5 Kelvin, so it's pretty very hot, so that and it's so hard that you actually see it in the X-rays. So this gas falling in, this will be, so this 10% of the mass, and then the rest is galaxy. But then another question is how do you identify clusters, okay, clusters of galaxies? So either you use as I've showed you so far, you use galaxies, and so you look at really close galaxies, and you see that what they are very clustered. That will be one way to find galaxy clusters. And another way is to look at the gas, right? So you can look either in X-rays, and people are conducting X-ray surveys, or you can look, for example, at the effect of the gas on the CME, and this would be, for example, the Sarnay-Zeldovich effect, okay? And those are ways to find clusters. But there are all kind of interesting questions about the subject, and the ones that the galaxy lensing can address are the following. So basically, how massive are clusters? Okay, and because they are the most massive object, their precise mass, they give you a very for example, their abundance, just the number of clusters you have at a given mass, it's extremely sensitive. It's a very sensitive probe of, for example, sigma 8, if you want, because the amplitude of perturbation will directly relate to the number of objects you form. And for example, if you were to try to probe sigma 8, the mass function, the number of clusters at a given mass, is proportional to sigma 8 to the 7. Okay, so it's an extremely sensitive probe of for example, normalization of the matter perturbation. Then you would, if you know the mass, you can also worry about the mass distribution. For example, what's the slope of the what's the mass profile, or for example, what's the are the substructures in the dark matter distribution is in. So all those kind of questions. Yes.
And then here, 1% and the 10% means that these are just baryonic ones.
Yes, that's right.
And then where is the dark matter? So inside or internal?
So this is also baryonic, actually. Yeah, I mean, both are baryonic. Yeah.
Yeah. So the 90 dark connector is inside the galaxy or internal?
The way it works is that it's it's much more extended than galaxies. Yeah. So you will have a dark matter halos, you know, just 1 megaparsec. And then you will have galaxies, which are usually slightly more concentrated. And then you have gas, diffuse gas all around. Okay. And if you look at X-rays, you will see this part. If you get galaxy, you will see only this part. And if lensing allows you to probe the dark matter that you can't see otherwise.
So you mentioned that you can measure sigma 8 quite precisely.
Yeah.
From measuring the mass of the clusters. You can also measure similarity from the power spectrum.
Yes.
So is there an agreement between these two measures?
Kind of, yes. So that's a good question. But for example, if you try trying to measure sigma from the power spectrum, as we saw yesterday, the power spectrum amplitude is proportional to sigma to the square, right? So where this one I told you is proportional to sigma a to the 7. So you see that in principle, clusters are much more sensitive to sigma. The problem is that with clusters, it's actually hard to measure the mass precisely. So it does degrade the signal a fair bit. But let's say to answer your question right now, it's depending who you are talking to, depending which observer you are talking to, there might be a slight tension between sigma coming from cluster or sigma coming from CMB or galaxy cluster. So the sigma coming from cluster would be more in the 0.9 range, and sigma coming from CMB or galaxy clustering would be more in the 0.8. So it's about right, but not exactly. But so. So it depends. Some people will blame clusters, some other people will blame CMB. I want to blame them.
When you say the dark matter, is the dark matter and the dark energy you are distinguishing?
Here, actually, dark energy on this scale, so at 1 megaparsec or megaparsec scale, dark energy is not really, it's still subdominant. So you would, so it's not, it doesn't really affect much, it will affect the number of subjects, it will affect the statistics of clusters, but it doesn't really affect the properties inside the clusters because it's totally virialized, so it's kind of decoupled from the overall evolution. So it's really mean mostly dark matter, yeah. Okay, so just to show you some pretty pictures on historically. So then what people discovered randomly, it was some funny elongated objects in looking at galaxy clusters, right? Initially, and this was the first one we discovered. It was debated about whether it was what it was. And so Pashinsky suggested it was lensing, made some computation, and in 1987, four collaborators actually confirmed they were able for the first time to do spectroscopy along this arc here. And so they measured, you know, spectroscopy here and here and here. And same for here, and they were actually able to show that the spectra of each, they're actually able to show that the spectra doesn't vary as you move along basically this arc, so that it really means that it comes from the same object. So that's how people get convinced that it was lensing. This was the first observation of lensing in galaxy clusters, okay? So it was a big breakthrough. And now since then, it really became an industry, right? And this is one of the most massive, prettiest picture you can see. And what you have here, you have a galaxy clusters, which is right in the middle. And you see a few bright galaxies. This is a very bright galaxy sitting right at the center of the cluster, as it often the case. And you see other galaxies. All these galaxies are bound together, right? So they are kind of orbiting together, and they're really trapped in the same potential well. And then you look at the distortion, you look at this object here, or here, 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 on a cleaver, you know, you see here and here. And this is like basically the distortion. These are background galaxies, so the galaxy that redshift twice or three times or more higher than the cluster, whose image is distorted by the galaxy cluster. Okay. And so it's kind of pretty. And if you are in a regime where you still have a strong distortion, but if you were to look, you know, that far away, if you were to look here, you would see regular galaxies. But if you were to measure their shape and the coherent, you will be, and if you average the shape as I described before, you actually be able to see that there's a coherent distortion, which allows you to probe the mass profile of the clusters of the scales, okay?
Can you see
the
splitting? Splitting of
here? Oh, here?
Not this, you know. Is what? For gravitational landing, in fact, there might be splitting.
That's right.
I'm just wondering if I can see.
I don't think you can see here because you're not in a really strong linear. If you to see the splitting, you will have to be much closer to the center to have a higher density. So I don't see you. You can see it here. So here is another, you know, clusters, and you look at all these elongated objects here, here, here. You see this arcs, almost arcs forming here, etc., and here too. And so people will use that and they'll model the shape of this object. Okay. Just looking at individual objects, they will take the spectra, etc. And from that, you can actually infer the projected mass profile of the clusters. And this is like, this is from the distortion field, the shear field you measure, which are the stick lines. You can infer the projected mass density of your clusters, and whose isochron controls are given by this lens here. And you see that basically you have a strong mass concentration here, and you see that, you know, the various controls, and including these clumps, subclumps of matter. Okay? So that's a one. I'm doing that, so I'm showing you pictures, but you can do that much more quantitatively and look at the this galaxy profile of the clusters, and you can compare that, for example, with other estimate of the mass of the cluster, like X-ray, etc., and you can learn gradually doing this kind of exercise. So, on a funny application, is that another funny application which was done like 5 years ago now. So, you just, if you are smart, you can actually, you know, that you knew about clusters before you knew about, before you were able to observe Gaussian lensing clusters. So, one, you can actually try to play a funny game, which is, now, I know there is a cluster here, so can I use this? I know there's clusters, so I know there will be lensing. This cluster is going to lens background population. So can I actually look for much more distant objects than can I look for basically objects which are magnified by this cluster I know? And so this way you can go to much higher redshift that you would be able to go to without lensing. And so people actually did that. So for a cluster which is well observed optically, okay, they looked for objects they looked for very faint objects which would correspond to, you know, basically highly amplified objects that you wouldn't be able to see otherwise. And they were able to find two images which are which match the, let's say, which are in agreement with a mass model for the clusters. And basically, there is some debate, right, that people are convinced, some people at least are convinced, and I think the majority of the community is convinced, now that actually using this kind of trick, using a telescope basically using what people call a gravitational telescope, we were able to observe galaxies at a redshift of 10, right, which would be the most distant galaxies we ever observed. And these are these two objects here. So it's 10, 10, yeah. So this one here and this one here. So you are really pushing your the resolution of the instrument, we are really looking deep into the noise. But this will be the most distant galaxies that have been observed. And so by just using telescope, by just using clusters are gravitational telescopes, so which is a very neat idea. And so to give you a perspective, Z of 10, right, it's an interesting redshift to look at, because that's where the universe, more or less where the universe reunites, right? So basically it's very, very soon after the moment where the first star formed, right? So the first star formed at redshift of 10, 20, 30. So Z of 10 is really, you are very close to the first objects in the universe. So it's really, it's quite exciting, okay? And another funny applications is what is called a bullet cluster, okay? And I'm sure you probably heard of that. And it was said to be the first direct observation of dark matter, or observation of proof. So the first might be a stretch.
Yeah, two previous, so one more.
Sure.
Yes, one. First framework. The first task of the mass, so 10 to 6, so longest.
Yes.
It's the meaning of first star, the mass of the 10 to the 6 solar mass. Then mass is about the mass of the supermassive black hole. So what is the meaning of first?
What is the meaning of this number?
Yeah.
So basically this is a number for, if you have so you were able to look at this object and you measure its luminosity, you measure its spectra, and so you are able to measure, to infer its mass, right, given the luminosity you see. And so this, so this tells you that this galaxy, that this redshift was about 10 to the 6. Well, oh, I see, no, I see what you mean. Yeah, so it's a very low, so the question is, it's a very low, so people argue whether it's a very low mass estimate. So which is, it's, so you can, so it's a very low, so it's a very low mass, so it means that this galaxy will contain very few stars, so it's maybe primordial stars, and as you said, it's almost the mass of a black hole, right? So, I don't know if it doesn't. It's obviously not a black hole, right? Because you see it this way in this in you see these lines, but I'm not sure exactly what it means for I don't know. So it would be a supermassive black hole at a redshift of 10. I'm not sure what exactly the consequence for that. Yeah. Okay. All right. Proofs that. So the bullet cluster. So you see this picture is kind of pretty. And what you see here, the blue, is the if you look at the population of galaxies in the background and you try to reconstruct the mass, okay, you can reconstruct. So it's mostly dark matter, and you reconstruct this mass distribution, and you see these two clumps, okay. And those are basically what you see here is basically two clusters colliding, okay? So, and then what you see in red, is actually what you measure with X, if you look at X-ray. So in X-ray, you will look at the gas in the middle, so you look at the intergalactic medium, so the hot gas I mentioned before. And what's interesting here is that you see that the gas on the dark matter as provalencing, let's say most of the mass you see in X-ray is separated from the mass you infer from lensing, which is in blue. Okay, so basically, the interpretation of that is that you see burning gas here and you see dark matter here. And so what happened, why is that interesting? Is that basically, so there is this, no, three components for galaxy clusters, galaxies, hot gas, and dark matter halos. And what happened here is that you have the collision of two clusters, okay, a big one and a small one, and the two collide. And basically, the dark matter is a gas with almost pressureless. So the dark matter will collide, they will go through, the two halos will go through each other, and they will almost not interact, only gravitationally, but there will be the interaction will be a much longer time scale. You will have, you know, oscillation, and the two will oscillate, and then they will eventually merge. But at the first pass, okay, they will go through each other almost, they won't see each other, okay? And the same thing for galaxy. Galaxy, which are a little bit of the mass, will go through. You can look at the galaxy as a gas, you can look at the galaxy within a cluster as a gas almost, and they will just go through, pass, and very, very little interaction, okay? On the other hand, the baryonic matter, like the gas, which is very hot, will interact strongly, and so they will form this. There will be shocks. There will be sharp structures you see in the middle, and the evolution will be totally different. And this way, you will be able to separate basically baryons or the gas from dark matter. Okay, and that's what you see here. That's the way we understand the system, and so. Here's a gas, and here you see like strong shocks forming when the gas is colliding, and so this way you can separate baryons from dark matter, and you can conclude that actually it was one of the first clean and separate observation of dark matter. Okay, does it make sense? So it's just a spectacular system. It's hard to, you don't learn that much from it, but it's just at least it's very compelling. It's a very compelling story.
Why don't galaxies have any interactions?
Because they are very small, right? So it's like really, you have, it's like, you know, it's just like you have a few thousand objects diluted within this megaparsec sphere. So the chances of when you have the chances of direct collision are very, very small. That's okay. Now I move to last subject, which is like the cosmic shear. Okay, so the cosmic shear is again another, it's a even it's a different regime. And this time you are interested in, you are trying to probe even larger scales, okay? And so what you will do is that you will do very, very large scale survey, like, you know, 100 square degrees, 1,000 square degrees, or actually eventually old sky. And you, you measure, you look at distant galaxies, redshift one or more, and you look at their shape, okay? And then you try to measure the coherent shape over all the sky. And so it, since you are looking at, and what's happening is that basically the light from, so that's a pretty ugly drawing, but I found, so what you have here is like basically the, in dark, it's dark matter, it's supposed to mean dark matter distribution, and you have, you know, the filaments I showed you before, and you have galaxy clusters, filaments, etc. And as the light emitting from distant sources propagate to us, it will be slightly, it will go through a set of slight distortions, you know, as the light goes through the cosmic web. And so it will affect slightly the shape of the galaxy we see, okay? But this is a very, very small effect, but at least it will go on large scales. So a more realistic picture is this kind of picture, which is there, which is like coming from N-body simulations, where again, you have, you know, filaments, clusters, and big voids, okay? And as the light distant object goes through this, so this intervening matter, it will affect the light path and it will distort the shape slightly. So that will be, the green will be the original shape, and this, the red will be the observed shape, okay? And so, quantify this, for example, here is a project. If you take, for example, the simulation I showed you before, and you project the mass, that's what you would obtain here, okay? And so you see, this time it's two, so you start from a 3D distribution, you project it to get a 2D mass distribution, which is what matter for lensing. But of course, you still get, even in 2D, you still observe the same kind of structures, so filaments, massive halos, and then voids, okay? And then you can also predict what the associated shear field or distortion field would be, and you see, you know, all these lines around object of going around filaments. And if you have a population of spherical galaxies in the background, totally randomly distributed, that would be the final. That's how they would appear to you, right? And by measuring the ellipticity and the alignment of each of these objects, by you are able to infer something about this distribution on these scales, okay? So by measuring, you can see that the distortion field here, you can see that if you, from that, you can measure the distortion field, which is these lines, you can actually learn something about the underlying dark matter distribution on larger scales, okay? Does that make sense? Or now, so the way to do, if you do statistics properly, you will end up with power spectrum again, which are like power spectrum of the shear field, so shear distortion, the shear field. And here's a prediction from what the shear field should be. It's a 2D quantity. So it's angular, it's a power spectrum, the angular power spectrum as a function of a multiple. So here you have large scale, small scales. And you see this kind of feature, power spectrum, which you pick basically here. And you see that again, this shear power spectrum is quite sensitive to cosmological parameters. For example, you have just an all flat model with various matter density, and you see that it does affect substantially the shape of the shear power spectrum. And when you change sigma, it affects, of course, the amplitude. Or when you, if you have a different equation of state. If you have a different equation of state, it will affect also the shape of the amplitude. So the
Now that the goal, there's a really big part of the community who is trying to make better measurement of this shear power spectrum. And from that, you know, the goal is to infer cosmological parameters. And the shear power spectrum, as is the case for everything lensing related, is basically you learn two cosmologies through two different set of through two effects. One is you learn about the matter distribution. So basically, you learn about the matter distribution on large scale, which is what we saw yesterday. You know, when we look at the matter power spectrum, the 3D1, and you also be sensitive to cosmology because you are this kernel, what we call the Lensing kernel, which is like the ratio, product and ratio of various angular diameter distances. Okay, so you are both sensitive to the geometry of the universe and also to the matter distribution on the matter distribution as function of redshift. So you have to see both to the geometry of the universe and the growth of structure. Okay, so which makes Lensing a very interesting probe, and also because you can see that it's a very different, you will have a very different cosmological sensitivity to cosmological parameters than you have from pure galaxy surveys or, you know, distance measurements. Okay. So problem is for one limitation for this effect is that I've been talking about galaxy clusters a lot. I've been talking at a very dense object, so it means that we are interested very much into the non-linear regime of things. Okay, so we are. It's not like the AO where we can send a linear regime or almost linear. We really, if we want to go to exploit fully cosmic shear surveys, we really have to have proper modeling of non-linearities, and this is something which is already important for current surveys. Current survey are probing basically from 4 degrees on sky up to 1 arcminute, and at 1 arcminute scale, non-linearities are already very important. And so, the only way to address this is basically to run n-body simulation, as I mentioned yesterday. So you really solve for gravity exactly, but for dark matter only. When you try to put the gas, you need to model variance and etc. So it's a bit of a limitation, but it's an act. At least you need to address it. And that's so if you the so qualitatively nonlinearities, they will add up, as I said yesterday, basically nonlinearities, very small objects collapse first, and then they actually become bigger and bigger, and they attract bigger and bigger objects. So basically, non-linearity will start on small scales and propagate to larger scales as time evolves. Right? So, what you expect on larger scales, you expect the linear theory to be still valid, and on smaller scale, you will need to take into non-linear corrections. So you will have, and you will have an increase in power on non-linear on small scales. Okay, and a non-linear scale increase with time. And this is, for example, what you observe here for this. This is a matter path spectrum for a given cosmological model. And you see that here is a linear, the solid line is a linear, and the non-linear would be this dashed line here. Okay, and you see that you have a very strong increase in power at small scale, let's say, you know, megaparsec. Or tens of megaparsec. And as you evolve in redshift, basically this power, this scale here, which is basically the set when this is qualitatively the nonlinear scales, and as you go to lower redshift, this nonlinear scales move down, okay, down in here. And so you really have to take that into account if you want to do things properly. Just to give you a hint of, so that's a theory, and it's very well motivated. In practice, cosmic shear measurement actually very difficult. There are a lot of limitations to that, and one of them is that basically you want to measure the shape of an object, and you want to. So any object, the shape of an extended object. Okay, so What you do is that you use it with a telescope, but basically you have an extended object, and what you see is actually this extended object, which is the image of the subject will be convoluted by the optical response of the telescope, so what we call the point spread function. So, and the telescopes are really good, but they're not perfect instruments. So even if you imagine a perfect punctual object, like imagine a star, if you observe it through a telescope, it will be distorted, it will be elongated. Okay, so that's what we call the point spread function, the PSF. And the problem is that, so if you are trying to measure a shape, you are trying to measure distortions, but when you measure it, you add an extra distortion from your telescope, okay? And so you have to find ways to correct for this distortion from your telescope. And not only is that, but this distortion from your telescope will depend, will vary in time, because like it will be, basically, you will be sensitive to the very detail of the shape, the geometry of your focal plane, which will, for example, depend on temperature. So as the night goes on, temperature will vary slightly, and the shape will vary slightly. And for example, it will also depend on the exactly where you look at, because the geometry, the stress on your telescope won't be the same. So basically, it means that when you use that from the ground, and then you observe that through the atmosphere. Okay, so you have not only your telescope does introduce some deformation, but when the atmosphere itself. There's turbulence in a higher, you know, in a higher layer of the atmosphere, and this will blur the object. So you are, and if you look straight up, you have a given optical depth for your, you have a given thickness for your atmosphere. And but if you look further lower toward the horizon, you have even more atmosphere. So it means that all these distortions, all these effects, you will have to, they will be varying across the sky. So you have to find ways to correct for all this in a kind of almost local manner on the sky. Okay, so it's that people spend a lot of time doing that, and basically the way you do it is you look at you will try to find stars which are like point sources for your purposes, and you measure your PSF looking at stars, and then you will have a map of your PSF distortion all over the sky. And for example, this is what the row. That's the distortion introduced by your PSF when you make this measurement on this field of stars. That's after correction, okay? And you see that basically it's about 10%, okay? So you have a 10% distortion due to the telescope, and then you try to correct that. And once you do this correction, you try to measure the shape of galaxies, the coherent distribution of the ellipticity of galaxy, and you can see that the distortion produced by your telescope by the PSF is also extremely coherent across the sky. So you really have to be careful to do that quantitatively, and basically, you know, you want to, and that's one of the strongest limitations when you try to measure across midfield. Okay, so the results that for the first several groups attempted to do that have been attempting for years to do that, and finally in early 2000, several groups finally succeeded. These are the measurements. Okay, you have from, so it's various teams, various instruments, so various systematics, and these are the measure you observe. This is the shear variance as a function of scale. Okay, and dashed line will be the best fit model, you know, various. Lambda CDM, standard CDM, and OCDM, you know, those are the current measurements. So it, you know, it's a qualitative agreement, so it's working. So the things have been improving since then, and you can try, using this, you can try to infer cosmological parameters, and those are the constraints people have obtained in the sigma 8 omega matter plane, okay? On all these groups, you have a strong, so I won't have time to explain, but you have a strong degeneracy between sigma 8 and omega matter, and those are like the various constraints. These groups are able to put on these two parameters, and they seem to be consistent. Now, if you combine that, interestingly, if you combine that with in the same plane, sigma 8 omega matter plane, so schematically, lensing gives you this banana here, banana shape, the CMB. According to exactly what kind of priority you would give you this kind of constraint. This is like in 2003, so it's a bit old now, but still qualitatively correct. This is what cluster counts will tell you. You know, you basically all converge more or less in this area. Okay, so interestingly, shear, cosmic shear is almost orthogonal to CMB in this plane, which makes both of them very complementary. Yes.
And that's like invariant fractions. Those are the allowed regions, or?
Yes, those are like since this is DVM, this one I forgot what it is.
Where do they overlap?
They overlap. They do overlap here, actually.
Just in that.
Yeah, a little more. But this one, I'm not sure about this one. Look at this one. Yeah. And this is like, yeah, this has been actually evolved on it. Things are working better. This is a bit old now. It's 5 years ago. Things are working better now. But, all right. Okay, one more. So I showed you some cosmic shear power spectra before. And here are the, for the next generation, so people are really planning to improve greatly on that, and people are trying to devise and to build actually satellites dedicated to cosmic shear survey, because satellites mentioned PSF issues and mentioned atmosphere. If you have a satellite and you make a survey from space, you get rid of no atmosphere, and also you expect that the stability, instrumental stability is much greater because space, you know, you are really cold and temperature doesn't vary. If you design your orbit properly, the temperature won't vary during across a day or across 4 months. So you have great thermal stability, which will give you much better systematics, and that's the kind of Airbus you expect, okay, on the cosmic shear power of the shear power spectra. Okay, the blue are Airbus, and you see that they are full. It's, you know, you should be able to distinguish between various models, you know, for different omega, the omega equation of state for dark energy very well. Okay, that's where people are going. And again, if you go for flat cosmology and you look at the equation in the plane of the equation of state on the dark matter and on the matter density, those are the constraints you obtain from a supernovae we saw yesterday. Okay, and these are the forecasts for satellites called SNAP or JDEM. And this is the Wood-Mensing estimate. Okay, and so you see that the combination of supernovae and Wood-Mensing would be an extremely powerful probe of the equation of state. And so that using this kind of techniques, people expect to have, you know, 30% accuracy or percent accuracy on the equation. Okay, and that's going to happen. This is going to happen in the coming, you know, coming years. So CFHTLS now is almost completed. 100 square degrees of the best survey currently. PanSTAR started, so it's happening, and it will map half the sky, a little more than half the sky from the ground. LSST is still controversial. It will happen probably later than 2012, more like 2015. And SNAP or JDEM, you know, there's a lot of politics involved, the name is changing all the time, but it's most likely will happen, and the time scale will be 2017 or 16, and then it should be extremely good with Lensing survey. Okay. So in conclusion, Lensing, chromatics, the bending of the light goes like that. And the boson quantity is a critical density. The Einstein radius allows you measurement of the Einstein radius allows you to measure the mass and close. Okay. Cosmic shear is probed nonlinear scales, and cosmic shear currently already gives strong strong constraint on cosmological parameters, and will give you even more in the coming decade. Right. So I'll stop here. We'll have a five minute pause, and then I'll continue. So do you have any question on this first part? Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to come back to this cluster picture.
Yes.
So if you the cluster size, as you say, what is that cluster?
Yes.
What's the size of the galaxy halo? Is that the half of it or what?
The galactic halo,
yes.
Is a kiloparsec. So 20 kiloparsec. Basically.
Just a
few. Yeah. So it's a 1,000 times bigger.
So then the radar is it outside the galactic halo or?
Einstein radio, it's a smaller galactic halo, yeah.
Inside or outside?
Inside.
Inside
the galactic halo. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Inside the galactic halo. Yeah.
kind of the best case scenario? How well can lensing constrain cosmology with respect to some of the other probes you talked about?
Yeah.
Like, how is it competitive?
It's very competitive. So, it's very competitive. So, so there was this big program in the US, which is like a big committee that was called the Dark Energy Task Force, which I am that, organizing the community to decide which probe of dark energy we should build, right? Which so people studied all kinds of things, galaxy clustering, cluster counts, CMB, cosmic shear, BAO, etc. And actually, cosmic shear was ranked as the most sensitive one. And so, So I think cosmic shear surveys are, so for this reason, and I think the most promising would be probably BAO and cosmic shear, and both will definitely happen. Timescale is uncertain, but it's definitely going to happen. So yeah, cosmic shear is really sensitive. It's really competitive. All right, so we make a 5-minute pause, and then we come back. Thank you.